Top of the Flops. All this and more coming up on This Week in Retro.
High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Who sues Yuzu?
The medium of music.
Sword reforged.
All this and more coming up on today's show.
Up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.
Hello, Dave. Back to the two of us. It's cozy. It's comforting. I like it when it's the two of us. I love a guest, but I like it when it's the two of us.
There's much more time to talk to you, Neil, when there's a guest on it. So there's so little time because there's so many things to be said.
There are. I'm always keen to hear what our guests have to say, as well as shoehorning our own opinions in. And it's a lot to fit into an hour, which is why we rarely do fit it into an hour. But we try best.
Yes.
And we'll try our best today. Let's talk about retro things this week, as we traditionally do at this part of the show. The Megatech, the Sega Megatech, the saga which started Christmas time, just after Christmas. I bought that £200 Sega Megatech arcade. I've probably waffled about it on the show before. I just want to say I finished it and I feel really proud of it. It's great. I've shown you a sneaky picture before the final episode's gone out.
Yeah.
Looks amazing. And the first lot of people who came to visit the cave got to play on it in its finished state this weekend. So I got some footage of that as well. And that's fast becoming the icing on the cake of any video I make now, is seeing people then actually get to use it in the cave. It's a whole extra layer of happiness that it brings me. So
yeah, the Megatech though is impressive. The side art on it that Dan has made for you is incredible. The end result is great. It's not just a that'll do, it's a kind of no, let's get it perfect.
Yeah. And well, a little spoiler there, Dave, but that will all be revealed in the final episode. And it's nice to be able to play on it without just being afraid to touch it because it's dirty. You know, it's just nice to enjoy it. Anyway, the next project down in the arcade, so I will do more arcade projects in the cave, but I don't want to do back-to-back arcade projects. So I've got another one in mind, which I'll do in a couple of months. But meanwhile, there's always stuff going on in the arcade archive. And I know Holly has started fixing Pac-Man. Why has an arcade museum not got a working Pac-Man? It's got to be an essential arcade to have. So that's going to happen soon. And we've put down a deposit on Paperboy. What are your feelings on Paperboy?
Didn't like it.
But
I'd never played it in the arcade. I played it at home on a joystick on my CPC, and it I don't think it's a very good conversion. I think the arcade machine has handlebars as if it's a bike, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. See, I'm with you. I don't think the home versions of Paperboy are very good at all. I don't think it's a great game on the home computer. I had it on the Amstrad CPC, having first played it at Butlin's Minehead. They had the arcade there. And like any Atari cabinet, it's big, it's impressive, it's stylized with the handlebars. It's not just a generic jammer cabinet. It's a really impressive thing to look at. And I wasn't very good at it on the arcade. So I'm really looking forward to getting it and actually playing it with the handlebars again and saying, well, was this a good game?
Or was Did you have a paper round when you were a boy?
No.
No, I didn't. No. I collected Littlewood pools, but I didn't do a paper run. So maybe that's why we're not very good at it.
Yeah. I would have, if the opportunity had come up, I would have done one to earn a little bit of money for some more games. There's still one that comes down my street here. And it's to deliver one paper, and I'm in a cul-de-sac. The poor lad, he has to come all the way up around the street to a dead end to deliver that one paper, and then pedals away again.
I wonder if anyone did a paper run and then spent their money in the arcade on Paperboy.
I wonder if anybody got knocked off their bike by a remote control car or a lawnmower on the loose while doing their paper round.
Or when they finished the paper run, they said, right, let's go in the obstacle course.
Get onto the stunt track, yeah. Jump over some rivers. That was the best part of the game, the obstacle course, easily. But yeah, I'm looking forward to revisiting it and saying to myself, well, do the handlebars make a difference? Was it a good game, or was it just the quirkiness that made it stand out and everyone remember it?
You see, just the quirkiness, but that's all important. The whole feel of the whole feel of it is important. The arcade cabs and making it feel just a little bit more than just a simple joystick and a screen.
How about you, Dave? What have you been up to this week?
Absolutely nothing retro this week.
Okay, I guess nothing at all. Nothing to report on.
Nothing to report on.
You haven't even dusted your games behind you, reorganized.
I have received that book. that ST Amiga Flame Wars book.
Oh, yes.
And I flicked through it. It looks lovely. I'm going to sit down and read it. My working week means that Monday is when I get a chance to do stuff, so I'll be sitting down to start reading that today.
Dave's got a book. Into Story One. Ooh, it's us from the future.
Ooh.
Oh, yes. This is an unusual thing. I don't think we've done this in the entire history of the show.
We've not needed to.
Our story is so up to the minute, so on point, that it's actually changed since we recorded this segment, hasn't it, Dave?
Yeah. About 15 minutes after we finished recording. We're going to at the end of the story, we're going to tell you what's happened afterwards. But we thought we'd put this bit in case you're already aware of it, so that you're not sitting there screaming at us going, yeah, but.
Yeah, punching the keyboard.
Yes.
So stay calm.
I think you'll find.
Keep the blood pressure down. It's still an interesting chat. It's still 100% based in
relevant.
Fact.
Yeah.
Relevant. So let's listen to it, and then we'll check back in at the end and see if we were right.
We've talked about Nintendo wanting to keep Dolphin off of Steam. Dolphin's the emulator. But they've gone much further with Yuzu, which is a Switch emulator. Yuzu is able to emulate games that Nintendo are selling at full price, so it's no wonder that they're going hard at it. Dr. Local has submitted a Verge article on it, and I thought it was fascinating in terms of how Nintendo are going after them and the reasons behind what Nintendo are arguing. Their emulators are not illegal. There's nothing inherently illegal about an emulator. However, in the USA, the DCMA, is it DMC? No, it's a DCMA, the Digital Copyright in the Millennium Act, prohibits, and this is in quotes, products that are primarily designed or produced for the purpose of circumventing a technological measure that effectively controls access. So it's talking about bypassing copyright. So for Dolphin, one of the reasons that Nintendo was arguing against it was that it included a key that was needed to decode the copy protection. Now, Dolphin said that including that was legal. Nintendo didn't agree, but it didn't go to court. It wasn't tested because Nintendo seemed to be happy with the standoff where Dolphin could still exist, but it wasn't listed on Steam. Listing it on Steam would have made it a bit more mass market, made it more accessible. Yuzu, though, doesn't include a key. You have to supply one from a hacked Switch, and the new versions of Switch have had that blocked, so you can't do it, or you can download it on the internet.
When you say blocked, they've blocked the ability to rip that key out of your
Switch, right.
Have they? Okay.
Yeah. Now, here's the bit that seems to me to match what the DCMA is talking about and what Nintendo are going after them for. They say that Yuzu is facilitating that piracy in myriad ways, including providing detailed instructions on how to get it running with unlawful copies of Nintendo Switch games, testing thousands of official Nintendo Switch games to verify their compatibility, and linking to websites that help users obtain and further distribute the prod keys. So prod.keys are the keys that you need to unlock it. Nintendo also says that developers have clearly extracted Nintendo Switch games themselves, bypassing encryption in order to test their own emulator.
Yeah, just a little example of what you're talking about there, Dave. I've gone to the yuzu-mu.org website, which is the official home of it. I've gone to FAQs. How do I get games? And it says, you are legally required to dump your games from your Nintendo Switch. To do so, please follow our in-depth quick start guide. And then there is a very in-depth guide as to exactly how you can rip your games. Now, some would say that's backing up and that's not illegal, but I'm pretty sure on some of the Switch games or all of the Switch games, there are disclaimers to say that that is not legal or the code remains the property of Nintendo. I'm not sure where you sit with that, whether it's legal or not. But more than likely, people are just going to go to a torrent site and download an already ripped game, aren't they?
Yeah. I do remember seeing disclaimers like this. This emulator doesn't include original ROMs, for example, and we won't tell you how to get the original ROMs. Munt, for example, the one for emulating a Roland sound canvas, doesn't come with the ROMs that you need for it, and it tells you need to find them elsewhere, but you just Google it and you find them. Interesting enough, though, I remember Amstrad released the CPC ROMs, and for the Amiga, you can pay a modest amount to Cloanto and get a valid ROM to use in your emulators. But what do you think, though, Neil? Is Nintendo attempting to be the thin end of the wedge that makes emulators illegal? Because this is how MAME and Mister and loads of other emulators work. They give you the emulator, and you then go and add things to them. And if you think about what MAME and Mister are for, without the games and so on, there's very little point to them.
Yeah, I feel like we've had this conversation before, but actually this is a very different approach to the conversation, because Nintendo are coming at it not at the emulator, really. It's about everything that's happening around the emulator in this case, isn't it? And they're doing that simply to protect their property, their intellectual property, and their profits, because I'm sure in the eyes of the Nintendo shareholders, it's very black and white in that way. People are using our stuff without paying for it, therefore it's affecting our profits. And we know it's a bit more complex than that. They're thinking, you took our thing, you copied it in software by reverse engineering it, and you gave it away. Now, the problem is, as proven all the way back to the likes of Electronic Arts, reverse engineering, when they reverse engineered the Sega Mega Drive with a view to releasing their own cartridges without paying the Sega tax. So they were doing it for profit then. That's fine, so long as it's done in a clean room and so long as it truly is reverse engineering and you're not ripping out chunks of code created by Nintendo in this case and pasting them into your own project. That is entirely legal, and I believe it remains an entirely legal thing to do. And that's why Nintendo have to go after them in this way, using copy protection circumvention laws or laying claim that clean processes weren't followed and providing evidence to back those claims up. But in this case, it's all about the piracy of games. And it's not clear if they actually have the evidence to back that up. We've seen this before from Nintendo. They know how much weight they carry. Everybody knows how much money they have and that they can pay the lawyers. And sometimes it's just the weight of the threat and the potential consequences that will get the creators to back down. In fact, not just sometimes, nearly all the time we've seen that happen. But with every case that it doesn't happen, it dilutes the effectiveness of that. And while Dolphin didn't end up on Steam, I believe it's still readily available and active and plenty of people are using it. And the Yuzu website is still online. So it might be that the effectiveness of Nintendo's approach in this way is starting to get less and less. I've read through the notes. There are claims, all of the case notes are available to read. I'm sure Duncan will put the link up to the story. And the notes include such things as, Nintendo are fully aware of the use of Yuzu by others in performing circumvention and in facilitating piracy at a colossal scale. So go after others. Are you going after others as well, Nintendo, or are you directing it all at this project? They specifically claim that copies of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom were downloaded over 1 million times before the game was published. You can understand their frustration with that. That's a bit worrying, isn't it?
That's not a small amount. No, that's got to impact. That's if you're a fan of Zelda and you've got to play that game, and you're able to play it early through piracy, then that's a lot of people not buying the game.
Yeah, and also you're either having your game put out in an incomplete state, or you're having your game put out in a complete state for free. This is not like, for example, sitting at the back of a cinema with a camcorder and recording a dodgy copy. If you're putting out the full game, it's the full game. You're getting it in all its glory for absolutely no money. So there is a very strong argument for a loss of profits there. So there's a whole lot going on around this case. It's going to be a really interesting one to follow, I think. It still sticks with me, others, you know, facilitating piracy at a colossal scale, and others are doing it. And it's so clear where others are doing it outside of the emulator itself. For example, you've only got to go on TikTok and start scrolling, and you'll see live streams come up, not even pre-recorded videos, live streams of people. I don't know if you've seen this, Dave. It's almost like a market stall scrolling through TikTok. You see people selling, I don't know, hey, buy 20 packs of washing powder in bulk off of me, you know, buy this, buy that. All very dodgy. I'd never buy anything in this way. But I always come across people selling HDMI sticks that go in the back of your telly with tens of thousands of ROMs already on them for £10 or £20. you know, where's the crackdowns on that? Why are those kinds of things not being cracked down on?
Well, it's because no one's losing out money like Nintendo feel they are here. I don't even think it's up for dispute. Clearly, Nintendo are losing lots and lots of money here, so that's why they're going down on it. But they will realise that the only weak point that they can attack on this realistically is either the people making the emulator or established websites doing it. They'll never crack down on guys doing it from their from a room in their house. They'll never crack down on market stalls and individuals doing it on eBay. They'd only manage to do it on the big operators.
Sure. And like Etsy's another one. You can just go on Etsy and buy a hard disk with all the ROMs. It's rife. So it's interesting. Nintendo is suing for piracy. And there's also a second count in the notes. In fact, I think there's four counts they're going after them on. But the second count is of distributing technology that circumvents the anti-piracy measures. So that's where they perhaps feel like they've got the gotcha to really drive this home. What would the result of it be if they're successful? Well, it's not going to be the end of emulators.
I don't think so. I mean, and I'll be honest, I don't have a Switch. I'll likely never own a Switch. So it's not the Switch part of it. It's not the important thing for me. I'm just worried that Mister or MAME or the emulators we use might end up suffering that way. But having read it all, I'm not too worried.
The current gen nature of this all is the key factor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the key to it all. So yeah, there's a 41-page press release. It's not a press release. It's the full court case notes that you can read through on the Verge article.
Yeah, I think there's a stronger argument for preservation on other things. This is clearly being used for mass piracy. As much as I want to be able to people to use an emulator to play their Switch games on it, this emulator doesn't allow them to play their Switch games without ripping them from the original distribution way. So it's not just simply a new way to play it.
No, the result will surely just be a more modular type of emulator, whereby the legal bits are legally distributed. The grey areas you have to go and source yourself, just as they've done with the keys. But even more so, it's difficult because only last week we were celebrating Exodus, and you know, you can download Exodus, the entire history of DOS gaming, from a torrent. You can get a 5 gigabyte version of Exodus, which brings up the menu and then actively goes out and downloads on demand every single game in the history of DOS. But then that's not Nintendo. That's not Nintendo. Nobody's really policing that. Doesn't make it any more right or any more wrong. But, you know, you can't really hold one opinion on this because it's Nintendo and then be all fluffy and happy about that because it's DOS gaming. Either you support it or you don't, I think. Ooh, it's us again.
Welcome back to the future.
Yeah.
So shortly after we recorded that, news broke that Yuzu have agreed with Nintendo to shut down their emulator entirely. So they're not going to distribute it. Obviously, the copies that are out there already can't be put back in the box, but there'll be no further development or promotion of it.
Exactly. And already the website has disappeared. The source code has disappeared. And they've put out a statement, Dave, haven't they? Which I would hazard a guess has had some Nintendo involvement in the way that it's worded.
Yes.
So I'm not going to read out the entire thing, but just a snippet from it. We have come to the decision that we cannot continue to allow this to occur. Piracy was never our intention. And we believe that piracy of video games and on video game consoles should end. Effective today, we'll be pulling our code repositories offline, discontinuing our Patreon accounts and Discord servers, and soon shutting down our websites. Now, Patreon is a really important part of this, I think, isn't it, Dave?
Yes.
Because they were bringing in how much money?
$30,000 a month.
Yeah. Now, why were people paying for that? Well, it was on the promise that they would, well, maybe not verbosely on the promise, but the expectation that they would get access to ripped games, the knowledge to rip games and pirate games, and sometimes games before they're even publicly released.
Yeah, they have also, what we haven't said is they've agreed to pay Nintendo $2.4 million. So if they've agreed to pay Nintendo $2.4 million, one has to presume that they've got at least $2.4 million, which you would presume has come from income from Patreon, from other sources as well. So this is very much a commercial operation. Yeah. It may not have started that way. It may have been led down a path. It didn't. Maybe they wanted to do something that was more pure at the start, but it has turned into, I think from Nintendo's point of view, it's turned into wholesale piracy, and that's why it's there. Now,
there is speculation that Nintendo were lurking in the Discord servers. No doubt they had a Patreon account there to keep an eye on what was going on. And I think it's probably that underlying Patreon income that really was a big red flashing light on top of layer upon layer of everything else that was going on for Nintendo. They felt they had to do something. And I'm not surprised. However, do you think this is going to have much of an effect on other emulators, Dave? That was the question.
No, I don't. And we do need to state what we're doing here. We're talking about recent events and how they affect retro. We're not experts on the Switch or Nintendo or current legal things, so we want to shine a light on how we think this will affect retro. And I don't think there's any reason to be concerned. I'm not losing any sleep over our emulators. The amount of money involved in our side of things is absolutely tiny. Almost all of it is done for preservation, for things that are not really sold commercially. There's nothing like millions of dollars going on. So while this is very interesting, and it's interesting they've gone down the route of this emulator is there to provide access to pirate software, and that's what they've fallen foul of, I don't think this is a worry for us, Neil.
No, I don't think this is reflective of the emulation scene as a whole. I support emulation or core creators in the FPGA scene in particular on Patreon. I pay an amount every month to say, I love what you're doing, keep what you're doing, because I respect the way that you are doing this to preserve the games or the gaming experience through your work. But this is 30, 40-year-old games. There is a whole other argument about copyright that we've been having offline, haven't we, on Discord this week, chatting about what is and isn't fair. But that is very different to current, even games that haven't yet been released, being able to play them and being able to get access to them and share them amongst this community. Very different, so I don't think it has an effect on the wider emulation scene.
I should also say this is not the only Switch emulator out there. It's not clear whether Nintendo will go for the other ones or whether this was just the loudest one, the one that was making lots of money. So I'm not sure what's going to happen there. I would imagine that in 20, 25 years' time, perhaps this will resurface and it will be the way that Switch games are preserved, because presumably at some point the hardware won't be able to cope with them. But for the moment, it looks as if this is whatever's out there will continue to be shared, but it won't be developed through that central hub and monetized in the way it has been.
Should we get back in our boxes, Dave?
Yeah, let's go back to our Wednesday life and leave you back to the past version of Dave and Neil in the future for you.
Ooh. Ooh. Dave, our show is kindly supported by who this week?
By PCBWay.com.
No way.
Yeah. Yes, way. PCBWay.
PCBWay. Incredible. Tell me about them, Dave.
PCBWay are a fabrication company that make PCBs and CNC milling and 3D printing and all sorts of other services, including, for example, being able to produce a Mr. Multi-System for you.
They can, as well as, anything you can think of in the open source retro world. It's there in their shared store where you can go and down, just put it straight in your basket. You don't need any prior knowledge of PCB creation. You can just get that ordered right there. But if you're a clever person like Chrissy and the board folk who are recreating PCBs left, right, and center, then you can use a service like that to upload your Gerbers. I believe that's the technical term for it. Your Gerber files.
Is that not baby formula?
I don't know that you'll get far by uploading that to PCBWay. Yeah. But you can upload your Gerbers and you can receive your PCBs. And we're very grateful for their support of the show to help us keep the lights on and to make Dave sound sexier than ever with the equipment that they support. So thank you, PCBWay.com.
Thank you.
Vinyl record sales are soaring. Cassette tapes are showing a resurgence. But did you know, Dave, that music on floppy disk is a thing? And not only is it a thing, it's a current thing with new releases coming out. Did you know that, Dave?
I knew it was a thing, but I didn't know it was a current thing.
Well, Signor_by445 shared this story with us on our subreddit. That's reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro if you'd like to participate. And it's the story of flop rock, the underground disc music scene. The article reports that discogs.com shows a healthy 500 plus floppy disc releases in the 2020 category, which is more than was documented for the entire period of the 80s, 90s, and, well, I say noughties. Do you say noughties, Dave?
Noughties I'll do.
Noughties,
yeah. Double zeros. I guess I didn't like noughties at the start, but now I've settled on it. I'm beaten.
It didn't sit comfortably with me calling it noughties at the start, but there was nothing better. Zeros, O's. Yeah. Anyway, in the decade so far of the 2020s, more floppy disk music releases, according to Discogs, because I might have a slight bone to pick with this, have been released than in the 80s, 90s, and noughties combined. Although I highly suspect the lack of releases that they are counting here is because the MP3 format, we just didn't have the computational power to use that in the home in the 80s and much of the 90s until the second half of the 90s. Now, why do I have a bone to pick with the article? Well, to be honest, if you're exploring the roots of floppy-based music, you need to take some things into consideration. So in this article, it reports that Billy Idol released a multimedia floppy disk with Cyberpunk in 1993. And it says the first of its kind. What it fails to mention throughout the article is the demo scene or music compilation discs going back to the 8-bit machines. I'm sure you were the same, Dave. I was putting floppies in my Amiga from the day I got it in 1989 just to listen to music in my room while I was doing other things. So there's a very important part of the story missing here, in my opinion. Did you ever just put a disc in to listen to on your... Oh, no, it was an Atari ST, wasn't it? Yeah, you wouldn't have done that.
Atari ST can do music just as well as Amiga. Just, unfortunately, it uses 80% of the CPU cycles.
True. Did you ever do it, though, Dave? Did you ever
just... Yes.
You did?
I used to put discs in to listen to the Crack Troll.
Yeah.
And leave them running, playing the Crack Troll, or sometimes just the game music itself.
Yeah, with the scrolling greets and everything, yes. And the little chip tune in there.
Yeah,
I did that as well, actually. It does, however, this article, it does acknowledge the size limitations that the media brings and the joy of the challenge of squeezing your art into a finite capacity disc. Reference is also made to the low-bit scene. Now, that's kind of new on me. I hadn't read into that, but apparently that's where countries were falling behind on internet speeds. While we were getting broadband, they were perhaps still on dial-up in certain countries. So they would stream or download music with a low bit rate. They could access the modern sites that were coming up and taking advantage of broadband, but it was very slow for them. So they would choose the low bit rate option, or they would have their own sites where they'd download low bit rate music, very compressed, lo-fi quality audio. And of course, now if you grew up with that, you're nostalgic for it. So there's a whole market of people nostalgic for that lo-fi sound, that digitally compressed lo-fi sound. And if you don't believe me, look no further than the streams that run 24/7 on YouTube with lo-fi music. I don't know if you've ever come across those. Yes, Dave?
No, but is that the same kind of idea as the oldies? When you hear music from the oldies from like my father's generation, for example, and my grandfather's generation, where it had that almost a muffled sound to it, but it's quite a cozy feel to the music.
I think it's the same. And do you mean as if you're listening to a record through a gramophone rather than a hi-fi stereo or that sort of thing?
Yeah, and it's not that, although the sound isn't as good, it does something to it that's quite pleasant.
has sort of a transient, wafty quality about it that just flows around. I like that. I'm feeling nostalgic just thinking about it. The article quote closes with a quote from musician Kai Nabuko, who says, "To me, the floppy represents a couple of things." He says, "Nostalgia, but also a punk ethos." He says, "It feels highly personal. The floppy, as fragile as it is, has to be handled carefully. The label or musician has to put a lot of thought into it. And I do think that they are adorable," he describes them as. There's also a lot of talk in the article about how temporary and fragile floppy disks are. But, you know, yes, they are. But some of them last just as long as a cassette tape or a VHS tape or plenty of other mediums. It just depends how it's stored and looked after and the quality of the media in the first place. So it's an interesting article, certainly written from a place of, I would say, traditional music journalism, because it doesn't dip enough into the demo scene, doesn't dip into the other ways that floppy disks were used to listen to music. And if you took it that into account, surely all music released on floppy disk in the 80s, 90s and noughties would be way higher than in the 2020s so far. So it's a bit of an odd one, but it's an interesting read, and I've learned all about the fact that they're still released on floppy disk. What do you think of this, Dave?
So I do like a chip disk. I had a couple for the ST. I couldn't tell you where they came from or what they were called. I'd like to get hold of them again, but I can't remember enough about them to do it. I do remember chip disks going beyond the actual physical format of the disc and it turning into just a little program with chip tunes in it, maybe 8, 10, 12 chip tunes in it and distributed, being called a chip disc, but you would download it. Whether they actually would still fit in a floppy, I can't remember. But I do think there's a beauty in keeping things small and neat. There's realistically 1.4 megabytes on a PC high-density floppy, and almost nothing I can think of these days takes up that little space. An MP3 file that you might listen to on Google Music, for example, is more than that per minute.
Yeah, some of the examples cited in the article, a new release, for example, floppy disk, it's an MP3 on the floppy disk, and it's 30 seconds long. So it's kind of experimental, if you like. That's not a teaser, that's the full song. So MP3s on floppy disks don't sit right with me. The minute I started ripping CDs to MP3s, I was putting them on a 100 meg zip disk. I was never saving my MP3s onto floppy disk. I mean, at a stretch, if a friend was absolutely desperate for a single, I might PK zip it across 4 or 5 discs and take it to them, but they'd have to be desperate for that. I certainly wasn't storing them myself on floppy disks. To me, music on a floppy disk is not an MP3.
Yeah. So there's two things in a floppy disk that I think belong there for music, and that's mod files. So mod files are they are not an MP3 file at all. A mod file is it's like a MIDI but with samples built into the file.
So it's a track made using a piece of software called a tracker. You've got all of the sound samples on the disc. The tracker is a description of how, when to play those sound samples. And then it just triggers the samples, at the right time.
And then, of course, there's just simple chip tunes, which are just instructions sent to whichever sound card is in the computer to process, or sound chip in the computer to process it. And those two things, I feel, really do belong in a floppy disk, because there's plenty of room, there is sufficient room on a floppy disk to do those without having to restrict yourself to 30 seconds.
And you did mention MIDI there as well, which...
Yes, of course.
With the right sound card, you could just play MIDI music straight up on your sound card, or you would squirt it out to a device, a MIDI device, a keyboard that would then play the music. But it still counts. Still counts.
Can you not MIDI? The size of floppy disk, though, is tiny. I don't think we really understand how small it is. If your phone has 128 gigabytes of storage on it, then it's 128,000 floppy disks on there.
Yeah. And also, shoot me down if I'm being unreasonable here, why not just use a tape? If you want to use an old medium, you can get 90 minutes of music or more on your tape. Why not?
I was thinking about the difference between a tape and a floppy disk and when one might be more useful. Certainly it's easier to copy floppy disks. If you have music in a digital form, apart from the capacity of the floppy disk, it's easy to copy a batch of them if you're going to go and hand them out. Whereas a tape takes more space, but a tape there's much more storage in a tape. So I guess the
much more horses for courses. Yes. Yeah. Well, as is touched on in the article, that's part of the challenge, the limitations of the disc. What can you squeeze in there? How long a song and how good a song can you get in there while retaining a semblance of quality that your ears might enjoy and not sounding like a ZX Spectrum loading a game? It's interesting. I'm going to go on Discogs and I'm going to have a little explore at some of these releases. It's not the only method. There's also releases of albums on cartridge in more recent years. So there is a certain novelty factor to that. But do read the story. I'm just going to leave you with one other little factoid, which I don't know if I've mentioned before, but it made me giggle when volunteer Derek told me at the Cave. Derek comes from South Africa, and floppy disks are not called floppy disks there. They are genuinely called stiffy disks. Because they're not floppy. They had floppy disks with their 5 1/4 inch disks, but the 3 1/2 they called stiffy disks.
So, I've done a little Google, and I've just found Chip Disc 4 The Essentials by Razer 1911, and it's 1 MB in size.
The fact that they weren't MP3s doesn't take away the fact that they were music discs, because you could get really good tunes. You would listen to them over and over again. And some of them would come up with a menu of 5, 10, even 20 tunes on one disc. If they were clever, they shared the sound samples and, you know, amongst different tunes. But you could get a full album on a floppy disc easily. So there you go. Disc-based music. I'm sure there'll be plenty of comments. Do please leave a comment and let us know your memories. This isn't the question of the week, but just leave a comment if you're watching on YouTube or wherever you're watching. What music discs did you put in to listen to? Should we make that our question of the week? We'll decide by the end of the show, but either way, leave a comment and let us know.
We have hit a milestone, Neil. Remember?
Did it hurt?
We asked, can we get to 100? We did. We got to 100.
100?
Patrons.
Oh, 100 twirlers. 100 official
twirlers. So twirlers. I want to thank the 5 new twirlers this week that made us hit that 100. So that's thanks you to Lewis, to Conrad, to Nick, to Mark, and to Rob. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you so much for supporting the show, guys. 100 patrons. Who'd have thunk it? Who'd have thunk it from our rambles every Monday? The other goal then, or the next goal, is to hit 10,000 subscribers on YouTube. We're gunning towards 9,000, but a nice round 10,000. And I haven't spoken to you about this before the show, Dave, so feel free to tell me to shut up or to tell Duncan to cut this out. But should we aim to do a live show from the Cave when we hit 10,000, would that be a good
goal? I'd like to. It would mean me visiting the Cave, and I like visiting the Cave. So yeah, let's tentatively suggest that we could do it.
Okay, so we could do it if we hit 10,000 subscribers on YouTube. And of course, first refusal to the patrons to come and join us on the day. And of course, it would be broadcast, what am I saying? Streamed.
Stream broadcast. Broadcast sounds a bit posh.
It does. It does. Sounds like we've got a truck parked outside the Cave with a satellite dish on top of it. Anyway, just an idea. We might do that. And very grateful to those 100 twirlers. Thank you. What have you got in your briefs this week, Dave?
In my briefs, we have Brassic Gamer telling us about a rather unfortunate thing. It's a video from a guy called Ron about someone who seems to have scammed him and other people using social engineering, befriending people and having a few small exchanges of things for sale, being very generous about it, and then later taking advantage of it and selling them items that apparently never existed and never sent them out. And it turns out a few people have been caught out this way. There's a lot of money involved. It's all very sad, and I'm not sure what the answer to it is. I don't want to say don't trust anyone, but yeah, it looks if the unfortunate thing is it's someone who was well thought of in the community doing this.
Yeah, the weight of people coming forward saying they did it to me too, they did it to me too, is well, it kind of makes it a little difficult to defend it in any way. The person who's having the fingers pointed at them has not come forward to offer any kind of justification or excuse that I've seen. If anything, they've gone offline.
So I don't. The important thing isn't that person. The important thing is that it had happened or it could happen. I feel that our community is very generous and very kind, and people are happy to send things to people, and they're sometimes we're perhaps a little bit open to that happening. So the important thing for me is be aware of it, and if you're not sure about someone, maybe have a quiet word with someone else.
Yeah, even if they're telling you they're friends with people you know.
Yeah.
Don't take anything at face value.
That was partly how it worked.
Yeah. We've had a couple more submissions about the new remastering of Dark Forces. Looks like everyone is excited about it. Is it released yet, Dave, that new Dark Forces?
Yeah, I think so. People have been buying it. I think it's released.
Must be if they're buying it.
Yeah.
I can see it here. Yeah, $29.99. Very positive reviews, released on the 28th of Feb. And it's from Night Dive Studios, as we know. Looks good. 4.5 out of 5 stars. There you go.
Weird Drummer 529 has submitted a very short time ago, so I've not had a chance to look at it properly. It's an Atari ST emulator on a Raspberry Pi, which does STTT and Falcon. I've not watched it yet, but it looks to be more than just doing basic games. It looks to do the operating system well as well.
Humans on eBay aren't all bad, submitted listener Squelch411. This is the story of a young gamer who listed a rare copy of the NES Zelda, hoping for something like $15,000 or $20,000. I mean, a lot of money to anyone. But apparently in its condition and the particular version that he had regularly sells, well, not regularly because it's rare, but has sold at auction for as much as $288,000. So he was selling it for less than 10% of the value that people have paid for it. Other eBay users, thankfully, contacted him to inform him what he had, and he pulled the listing and I'm presuming he's relisted it.
He sold it for $288, I think.
Oh, he sold it for $288. Yeah.
So it's a happy story. I mean, I don't know that I'm happy that
whether
games
or not
cost
you agree
that, to
with
get.
That value.
Yeah,
yes.
But I'm happy that he didn't then see his game sell for $288,000 after he sold it for $20,000.
And it just goes to show, Dave, there might be bargains out there still. But do the right thing.
Yeah.
This is something that I grapple with when I get donations to the cave. So I posted on Twitter last week that I had an extremely generous donation to the cave of the Great Guiana Sisters for the C64.
Clone of Super Mario World, is it?
Yeah, yeah. And even on the front, it says in graffiti on the wall in the art, the brothers are finished or something like that. A direct attack at the Mario Brothers. And the game was quickly pulled from the shelves because, guess what? Nintendo threatened to sue. I think quite rightly, probably, in this instance. So it's become quite a rarity. Regularly goes for £500 or so on eBay. And it's very important when somebody makes an offer like that I make it doubly clear, triply clear, that they know the value of it when they're donating it. I would have no problem with someone going, oh, I didn't know that. Actually, do you mind if I don't? I could use that money. Not a problem at all. It's really important that everyone's upfront and honest.
Yeah. So you stuck it straight in eBay, didn't you?
There you go. Yeah, paid for the holiday. No, I didn't. I've actually now been shopping for glass cabinets to put it in because I want to display it. to visitors in a safe way. Yeah. Lots more stories like that appear on our subreddit daily. So check in at reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. Submit your own stories that you might like us to discuss. Leave comments on other stories that you see there. Chat amongst yourselves. And also head over to our Discord server, discord.gg/rmcretro, where there is the cave chat rooms, and there's also a dedicated This Week in Retro room. And if you're a Patreon, Dave, what happens?
If you're a twirler, then you get a lovely magenta username.
Amazing. Show off that status.
Have you ever swung a sword, Neil?
Not in anger, Dave.
Well, me neither. And something else I've not done is played any of the broken sword games. They're made by Revolution Software.
What's your name, Chris?
Yeah, I know. I should have played them, though. These are point-and-click adventures. They really do appeal to me, and I've not played them. But thanks to a submission from Novel Conversation 18, we're aware of a new Kickstarter from Revolution Software for a remaster, a remake of their original Broken Sword game. And in the Kickstarter video, Charles Cecil, one of the founders of Revolution, talks about how in the 90s he loved getting big box games full of wonderful collectibles, and part of the joy of a new game was the unpacking experience.
Charles was actually at the Crash Expo some months back, so he is very much around and getting himself involved in the retro scene, and seemed like a lovely guy. I had a brief chat with him while he was being mobbed, actually. He was signing a lot of posters for people, along with Tony Warriner. So he seems like a nice guy.
Well, I definitely agree with him on the unboxing experience. And he talks about it being 25 years. I don't know what it's been 25 years since, because the original game came out in 1996. They did an enhanced version in 2009, so I don't know where the 25 years is. But he says this new version is substantially enhanced. He's actually been in the industry for years. He was making games with Arctic Software in the early 80s, Simple Text Adventures back with them. And this has gone on a long way. It's actually not the only game I know them of. I know their earlier two games, and I've played their earlier two games, Lure of the Temptress and Beneath a Steel Sky. They are both point and click text adventures. Lure of the Temptress came out on ST, Amiga, and PC in 1992. And you took the role of Dermot to overthrow an evil sorceress. Charles and Tony Warriner had worked together at Arctic Computing. They made Revolution with a couple of other guys, David Sykes and Noran Carmody. I'm sure I haven't pronounced that correctly. And they said they wanted to get away from how twee Sierra games were. And I think they tried, and I feel they succeeded in the two games that I played, to make a game with a much more serious and convincing setting, but still to put the comedy and the irreverence in.
A little bit dismissive to call Sierra games twee. It depends what era you're looking at. They're talking
about King's Quest in particular, and they were talking about the setting for King's Quest, and it was a bit fairy tale kids stuff rather than
it was, but that was its intention,
they were looking for something it? Yeah, they were looking for something different from that.
Yeah.
It's a more credible setting, maybe a bit darker. Maybe that's the British side of things. I don't know. Beneath a Steel Sky was a DOS game for me, but I know Amiga owners got theirs and they had a disc nightmare because it came with so many floppy disks, famously, and pushed people into, Neil,
the CD32.
I was going to say buying a hard disk.
Oh, there you go. Probably the latter, yeah.
Yeah. As for Broken Sword, I feel like I've been saving it as a treat that I know I'll enjoy. I've got a keep case compilation I got for a few quid on eBay a few years ago as a treat that I know I'll enjoy playing. I have double-checked my understanding of it, so I know I'm not wrong in what I think about it. It's a modern-day adventure investigation, sort of like Indiana Jones, sort of like Da Vinci Code, which deals with the Templars. So it's right up my street.
If that was right up your street, then was Gabriel Knight not up your street?
Gabriel Knight?
Yes.
No, I haven't played that either.
Oh, okay. That was a good one. I enjoyed that.
Yeah. Sins of the Father.
Yeah.
That's another one.
Well, that's the sequel, wasn't it? Sins of the Father. What was the original one called? Hang on. No, you're right. Sins of the Father was the first one, and then you had The Beast Within, And the third one was called Blood of the Sacred, Blood of the Damned. And that's when it went 3D.
Yeah, everything had to go 3D, including Broken Sword went 3D at one point, although it was well received when they went 3D. Mm.
But yeah, just Gabriel Knight is a good example of a gritty Sierra game, I'd say, yeah. Just to counter the twee claim. Yeah.
Yeah. The remaster is very interesting, though. Looking at the Kickstarter page, you can see the original game is indeed pixel art, and it's very well done. Now, they're turning that into 4K. Now, that's got to be a bit of a risk, because well, they managed to please people who remember the original Broken Sword in 1996. It was called Circle of Blood, if you're in America. You may know what is that. I don't know where the 25 years that Charles mentions in his tweet came in. I'm missing something there.
Maybe he's just misremembered. We all forget a decade when it comes to retro gaming. The Mega Drive only came out 10 years ago, you know?
Yeah. They have an ace up their sleeve, though. Veteran Don Bluth artist Ewan Cahill initially drew the outlines for Broken Sword in pencil before scanning them in to be digitally turned into pixel art. So they're going back to Ewan's original pencil outlines and then repainting all those backgrounds by hand to retain the original, they call it stylistic base and original charm. We are bringing these classic Broken Swords backgrounds authentically into 4K. So that's not, it's not as bad as what you automatically think. You think, oh, they're turning pixel art into 4K. Well, no, they're turning what became pixel art into it. So going back to before the pixel art, the original source. Now, the Kickstarter funded in minutes. It's now sitting at 6 times the goal. So instead of the £50,000 goal, it's at £380,000. And there's still 20 days remaining in this Kickstarter when you're listening to this. And, of course, it will go on for 5 or 6 days and longer since that that $380,000. So it's going to sail past it. And I suspect they might have known that because there's no stretch goals on there. So I suspect they might have known that, and I'm very tempted to back it. But this isn't the first time they've kickstarted. Broken Sword 5 was done in Kickstarter 10 years ago, and Kickstarter 10 years ago was a very different beast than it is now. They asked for $400,000 and they got more than double.
Well, the way you've described this, Dave, this is not a low-effort job. I love the fact that they're redoing the art. Of course, the outcome of that will come down to the artists that they choose. The Kickstarter funding will determine if they can afford the artist, but I'm sure they've already got someone in mind. I'm sure it's all explained in the Kickstarter. Do you know, will they be using an original artist from the original games, or
I'm not sure,
a Bluth Studios veteran or something like that? But they've got the money to do it now, so this is not a low effort job, and I applaud a simple Kickstarter, a Kickstarter that doesn't have a billion stretch goals and 300 different mugs and mouse mats and everything else, a link to an external website to top up your Kickstarter, all of these crazy things that people do to try and eke more money out of it. I'm backing the thing because I want the thing. Everything else is just noise. I love a simple Kickstarter, so I applaud them for that.
Sometimes you feel that with some Kickstarters, the stretch goal is something that should have been included in the original thing anyway, as if it's been taken out to be added back on as a stretch goal, and that makes it a bit muddy.
Yeah. It's certainly a series, if we're talking about the series in general, that's earned its keep through re-releases, including, to name a few, the complete DVD collection, released on Steam, released on iOS as a few different versions, but you can get the Broken Sword Mega Bundle today for $9.99. On the App Store on Apple. Keeps on selling. It's a game with a real following, and deservedly so. The original game came out in 96, as you said, and perhaps the reason you didn't play it, Dave, is because it was supremely uncool to be making 2D point-and-click adventure games in 1996. This was the year of Tomb Raider, Quake, Mario 64, Duke Nukem 3D. So I did try it, but I kind of turned my nose up at it at the time, and that was my loss. Because it is a game that is stunning with its 2D artwork. It uses it to great effect. It didn't for a second need to be 3D. That's just where my head was at the time. Give me 3D. Show me what my processor can do. Show me what my new graphics card can do. 3D, 3D, 3D. None of this Sierra and LucasArts 2D point-and-click adventure.
Even LucasArts were doing 3D at that point, though.
Well, but 98 you had Grim Fandango, which was 3D Resident Evil style. Sorry, Alone in the Dark style. Let's not claim Resident Evil set that standard.
When was Full Throttle?
Full Throttle was earlier than Grim Fandango, but that wasn't three. Well, it had pre-rendered 3D FMV scenes, didn't it?
Yeah.
So it wasn't 3D, and you had The Dig, which was very nice 2D with a really lovely orchestral soundtrack. So they were, you know, they were throwing lots of things at the technology. Broken Sword was, you could definitely see the heritage of that. I didn't realize it was a Don Bluth animator. You can definitely see that there. Don Bluth famously plied his trade originally at Disney using the very traditional 2D hand-drawn methods of animation, and then set up his own studio when he kind of fell out of love with the management methods of Disney. And then Disney moved towards that computerized style along with the likes of Pixar. But he kept it to those original 2D roots and traditional methods, setting up his studio in Ireland, I think it was. Got lots of tax breaks and offers to set up in Ireland. So that's where he positioned his studio. And obviously passed on those skills to others. And then it appeared originally we had Space Ace and we had Dragon's Lair, included the Don Bluth animation. Yeah. But I didn't realize that lineage carried on through to Broken Sword. So that's a really nice thing that you've tied together for me. I like that. Yeah, as an aside, another aside, sorry. There's a book called Revolution, The Quest for Game Development Greatness. It's by Tony Warriner of Revolution. Brilliant insight into his own career. Very detailed chapters into the forming of Revolution, the development of Broken Sword, Temptress, Steel Sky, all of those games that he was involved in. He was a techie, so he gets into the nitty-gritty and really explains the tech behind some of these games, as well as the formation of the company, Charles's part, everyone else who was involved. I read a lot of books about the industry, and Revolution is well up there. So highly recommended if you want to know a bit more about this game, Broken Sword, and Revolution Software.
I think I'm going to back this. It seems to me a game that I should have played, and I haven't. And what a way to do it, to get the box in my hand, to play the enhanced version. It should be amazing for me to do this. It should be great. But I'm now wondering if they're going to work through all the Broken Swords and do them this way. If this is a stunning success, maybe they'll do them all that way. Link in the show notes to the Kickstarter. We're not endorsing it, I'm excited by it, and I'm probably going to back it myself.
Time now for our community question of the week. Adobe, love or hate their products, was the question last week. When did you first use their products? Which of their products did you replace, and what did you replace it with? Which of them do you still use today? This all prompted by the 34th birthday of Photoshop. Dave?
Yeah, should we drop Duncan in it?
Go on, you can do it.
We have to, because a couple of people replied to it. When Duncan put this question up, we put it on as Abode rather than Adobe.
Abode.
Abode. And a couple of people, correct. Cheeky responses to poor Duncan.
He's overworked. Let's not lay into poor Duncan. So let's see what your answers were. Have you taken the thread out of contest mode, Dave?
I have slammed the door shut on contest mode.
Fantastic. So the top answer is from Mystic Greg. He says, sorry to be that guy. Do you mean Adobe?
Yeah, that's why I had to throw Duncan in it, because otherwise we'd not know.
Okay, we'll skim that one. I'll read the next one. Weeping Scorpion 1982 says, to this day, essentially the only piece of Abode software I use is Acrobat Reader. But I've been happily using it for 20 plus years, or however long it's been out. Not a fan of the subscription model, so on the fence about future uses of Adobe software. And by the way, for the longest time, I thought Adobe was pronounced with two syllables, but boy, was I surprised. Adobe rather than Adobe.
Adobe.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard plenty of people call it Adobe, so you're not alone in that. And yes, Neil, I also love Microsoft Access. I love it so much that sometimes I install Access 2.0 from floppy disk just because I can. And now I'll shut up. What a guy. Weeping Scorpion, you're my kind of person.
Jeff Mendoza says they're like the EA of corporate software. Is that fair?
I don't fully know the history of who they've bought up, what competition they've crushed. I'm sure there's plenty of that that's gone on. You don't get to be in that position in the industry without being, pretty hard-nosed and sometimes bullying. Yeah. Read another one because that was such a short answer, Dave.
Darth Scooter, which is a wonderful username. I'm imagining Darth Vader going about in a little scooter. I remember making newspapers with Adobe PageMaker back in high school about 1990. It was the first time I ever heard the term WYSIWYG, which was drilled into me at school, and it means what you see is what you get. And it was an evolution from word processors, which just had the text showing there, to what we take for granted now, which is how it'll look like in a bit of paper. It's weird to think seeing it exactly as it were turned out would be such a unique selling point. And you're right, Darth Scooter, it was. It's just, we take it for granted now, but back then, if you were in, what's the name of the, I can't remember a single name of any software at all, word processing, WordPerfect, for example. Yeah, AmiPro, WordPerfect. you would just see it as if it was a notepad file rather than the formatted way in the fonts at the right sizes you would see now.
Okay, WordPerfect. AmiPro ran on Windows, so that was a bit more WYSIWYG. But even software that claimed to be WYSIWYG, a lot of it didn't come out on the printer exactly how you wanted, or it was just really difficult to align things exactly as you wanted. Whereas some of the more premium products, such as Adobe PageMaker, they prided themselves on the fact where exactly where you put it. Quark Express was another one, or Quark. Exactly where you put the thing is exactly where the thing will come out on the paper. And that was worth a lot of money to a lot of people. None of this Microsoft publisher business. and Session Pristine 4977 says, I remember in late 1993 working in the IT department of a large steel company. The IT manager coming to see us and him talking about a software product that would change the world. I was very doubtful. The product was called Acrobat. He explained that you can print to it and then send someone the Acrobat file so that they can read it without being able to change it. It was the era of supposed paperless office. He organized a small site licensing for both the reader and the publisher, and he was completely correct. And 30 years later, I still use Acrobat on a regular basis. Like Neil, I like my MS Access. Not really. SQL rules. Damn it. Yeah, the uptake of PDFs. I still use PDFs. Adobe open sourced it, didn't they? Made it free.
I think
available.
So. I don't think they own the format anymore, and that's what frustrates me. That I can't seem to find a good PDF reader that will search text in a directory of PDF files.
But I mean, I regularly use the up-to-date version of Microsoft Word, and now there is just the option to save as PDF. The same across all the Office products now. It's there, and it's a really easy way of sharing things with people. And that evolved, didn't it, into being able to digitally sign forms?
Yes, there's a lot of that now, and there's rights on the PDF files, what you can and what you can't do. I want to read the next one from Fiskit, and it says, just because of what the last line he said is, he says, the nearest I've been to Adobe products is making wattle and daub walls for a den when I was a kid. Photoshop never made it to the Amiga, so Photogenics was the alternative, and now I use GIMP, Krita and Fire Alpaca, which sounds like a Jeff Minter product, but it's not. And he says, I wonder what a Jeff Minter paint program would look like.
Fire Alpaca. Fantastic.
Yeah. The alpacas.
Someone also tagged us on Twitter after listening to the last show and said they use paint.net, which is a perfectly good package for a lot of tasks that people use. So paint.net deserves a mention, I guess. Thank you to everyone who's taken part. Lord Bolrak, Antiques for Geeks, I Am Amiga, Chromatic Ore. lots of detailed answers. So thank you very much for taking part in the question of the week. And that leads us to our question of the week for this week, which is, it's based on our story about the music and floppy disks. Quite simply, what's the most fun you can have with a floppy disk? A single floppy disk, that is.
The innuendos, Neil. Are you intending to have those innuendos?
I have faith in our listeners. I think they will take this very seriously. Perhaps they'll tell me about the Microsoft Access databases they like to make and save on a floppy disk. They might make a database of all their floppy disks and store it on a floppy disk. What's the most fun you can have with a floppy disk? I'm not going to specify the capacity or the size of the floppy disk. That's up to you. Head over to our reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. Question of the week will be pinned at the top. Please do submit any stories you might like us to discuss. Pay Duncan a compliment. He always likes that. And thank you so much for listening. Dave, if people want to become twirlers, remind us where they go.
They go to patreon.com/thisweekinretro.
And please head to This Week in Retro on YouTube and hit that subscribe button to try and help us reach our 10,000 goal. And in the meantime, I'll try and persuade Dave into driving all the way down to the cave, because it's the other end of the country, to do a live show. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend if you're listening to us on Saturday morning, the rest of your day if you're not. And I'm going to get back to my eggy bread, Dave.
Eggy bread?
Cinnamon and orange eggy bread with banana. That's my breakfast today.
I like it with I like it with a bit of cheese in between it.
Oh, that's more of a lunch thing. More of a, yeah.
Yeah. Is that, what point does it become a croque monsieur or croque madame?
That's definitely going to involve the cheese and the egg. Yeah, whereas with eggy bread.
We need Ollie back on to tell us about these French things.
Okay. Have we got French a guest next cuisine. Week, Dave?
I haven't got anyone booked yet.
Okay, but you have got more guests booked.
I haven't got any more guests booked, Neil.
Oh, okay.
I need to book some guests.
Okay. Should we wrap the show up?
We'll wrap the show up. I feel as if we've wrapped the show up already. We're now whittling on.
Let's do the waving thing. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
He's waving.
I'm waving.
Bye.
This Week in Retro was presented by Neil from RNC The Cave and Dave. It was produced by me, Duncan Stiles. The podcast version of the show is available through your favourite podcaster, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And the video version is available on the This Week in Retro YouTube channel.
Join our community subreddit at r/thisweekinretro to suggest and vote on the stories we cover on the show. If you watch This Week in Retro on YouTube, please give us a like and subscribe to help us reach new viewers.
If you enjoy our show and would like to support it, then please check out the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or description. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.